with the precision of a lawyer on 15 minutes, Jerry. That was extraordinarily accurate. Jerry mentioned two key writers on global cities, and one of them is our next speaker, Dejan Sucic, who is many things. He's an author. He's on several books on cities. He is the writer for the national British newspaper called The Observer. He's just published a book called The Edifice Complex, and as of Monday, he becomes the dean of the School of Architecture in Kingston in London. So, Dan, if you could come and talk about the architectural content of these three cities.
Good morning, and thank you. I'm here to introduce the word architecture into this conversation, I hope as painlessly as possible. I hope to talk about architecture in a way which might suggest that not all architects are ego-obsessed egomaniacs bent on becoming celebrities at the expense of all else. And I'd like to begin by mentioning the name of Cedric Price, who was an English architect who built almost nothing while he was alive, but he had a way with ideas and words that have left more of a legacy than most architects who spend their entire careers building. It was Price who suggested that, given the treacle-like speed of the construction process, all buildings are out of date before they're finished. Thank you. You know what he means. A modern office used to be built around a mainframe computer sitting at the center of a deep plan block housed in sterile conditions, like a hospital operating theater. But even before its acolytes had moved into those offices, this pampered computer god had been supplanted by laptops sitting on every desk. Airports that were first planned for Boeing 707s have to operate with the Airbus 380. Financial services offices used to be built around deep plan trading rooms like football pitches, but that was no longer the way that dealers did business, even before they were finished, and those deep plan trading rooms were instantly made redundant. I think that even Cedric Price might have been a little unnerved by Shanghai. Architecture happens here so fast that it stands a better chance than most places of avoiding that particular trap that he warned against. It's not being made redundant before it's finished that's the trouble in Shanghai, as far as I can see. Here, the problem may be more likely to be that construction starts so fast that there is no time to work out just exactly what a building is going to do before it's built. Very often, it seems to turn into something else en route. Second slide, please. Shanghai is one of those cities that had to build an idea of what it was going to be before it could start living that future. When the City Planning Museum, which is one of the places that all we visitors come to see in Shanghai, was first put up, the city, as far as the world outside China was concerned, was a place that might have been seen to have gone to sleep. It was no longer the financial center that it had once been, nor the cosmopolitan hub that it was in the 1930s. So the first step that it took to transform itself into a new kind of metropolis was to announce to the world what it was going to be. And that, ultimately, seemed to mean what it was going to look like. Slide three, please. Shanghai built a new skyline that is famous now. A skyline that could be understood as an attempt to measure itself against its rivals. Pay attention is the message of all those towers. They may not be as beautiful, but they send precisely the same signal that Siena wanted to send when that Italian city built the tower on its town hall almost 300 feet high 700 years ago. Build the towers, seems to be the message, and the people will follow. And that seems to be still an unstated belief now as it was in Siena. Towers are symbols, but they are also a vital step in achieving the substance. Next slide, please. Shanghai, of course, is not the only city in the world that believes in the uses of symbolism as a practical planning tool. Look, for example, at the enormous symbolic investment in the reconstruction of the open wound in Lower Manhattan at Ground Zero. Next slide, please. Despite the best efforts of Larry Silverstein, the developer, and David Childs of SOM, his architect, to persuade us that they are motivated simply by the cold logic of hard cash, it's perfectly clear that the Freedom Tower at Ground Zero is intended to send a signal, or signals. The project is full of symbolic readings. it's an attempt to build a skyline that is telling us something about the nature of the city it belongs to, or at least the nature of the city as certain significant individuals see it. And even the latest, most negative readings that Karl Weisbrod mentioned just now still seem to send a symbolic message about how New York sees itself. Next slide, please. Here is the Statue of Liberty in abstract form. Here is a reminder of the American Constitution and the Declaration of Independence of 1776, as spelled out by the height of the tower in feet. Next slide, please. Here also is some sort of subliminal reminder of Minoru Yamasaki's lost twin towers, a gesture of continuity and defiance. And of course, those original two towers had themselves been an attempt to create a distinctive landmark for New York. It wasn't just that they were very tall, there were two of them, which, banal a gesture as it might be, ensured that the world knew exactly where they belonged, because they didn't look like anywhere else. Next slide, please. And London is also using tall buildings to signal something about itself. In this case, Renzo Piano's tower for Irvine Cellars at London Bridge is certainly an example of the highly symbolic uses of building. It's part of a deliberately encouraged attempt to make London look more like Shanghai, perhaps, encouraged by Mayor Livingston. Next slide, please. Mr. Sellers, the developer of the London Bridge Tower, has managed to sign up his first tenant, the Shangri-La Hotel Group. Without the prospect of putting their hotel in what will be the tallest building in Europe, it's absolutely inconceivable that the company would ever have dreamed of putting a luxury hotel in this particular location, on top of a commuter railway station, in the midst of a bleak piece of inner city, on the unfashionable south side of the river. Next slide, please. No doubt the decision to bring the Olympics to London in 2012 will make them think that they weren't taking quite such a crazy gamble. Next slide, please. One can say no European city has done more to reinvent itself in the last decade than London. Next slide. Next slide. It's a city that is going through a once-in-a-lifetime burst of growth and transformation on a scale of ambition not seen in Britain since the 19th century, when London went through its first, or perhaps last, great period of metropolitan growth. That was the era that saw the huge expansion of the underground railway system, the completion of the mainline railway network, the cutting of major new roads through the existing urban fabric. Then, as now, a concentration of large-scale interventions has served to transform the geography of the city. And it is in this context that the cumulative impact of individual projects needs to be understood. The shift began in the 1980s, when a financial center on a world scale, in the shape of Canary Wharf, erupted from the site of what had been a derelict banana warehouse in just 5 years. It happened through a combination of the unforeseen use of tax subsidies, originally devised to encourage light industry within the city, and a more relaxed planning regime. This, then, was an old economic order giving way to a new one made visible on the skyline. The shipping container killed off the old Port of London. The glittering towers of Canary Wharf loom over the browbeaten east end of the city in the streets in which the cleaners and the catering staff who service these towers live in another parallel world. Next slide, please. Why does it have to be so tall? The Prince of Wales once asked about the first and tallest of the Canary Wharf towers of its American architect, Caesar Pelli. The answer, of course, that he was too polite to give was obvious: to make nowhere into somewhere. This was grand vision British style. The offices went up first. Next slide, please. The infrastructure to get people to fill the buildings came second or third. But when they were built, there was a deliberate attempt to give them the visual coherence. Next slide, please. The new Jubilee Underground mass transit line was built after the towers went up in a bid to convince Londoners that the underground was a civilized transport system, a reflection of a civilized public realm. Next slide, please. Next slide. London was going through political as well as social changes. I'm coming to that. Which were also given a physical dimension. 20 years ago, the government of Margaret Thatcher abolished the Greater London Council, and to make sure there was no chance of the administration that she hated so much would ever return, the County Hall building, in which its councillors had deliberated for almost a century, was sold off to a Japanese financier and turned into a curious mix of hotel, art gallery, Chinese restaurant, and aquarium. Tony Blair's administration resurrected pan-London government, and it was time to send another clear visual signal. Next slide, please. The new London Assembly's 500 staff and its 26 elected members could easily have been accommodated in an anonymous office building with no public face or iconographic significance. It would have been presented as the financially responsible option, but it would have left London's government invisible and lacking any sense of authority in its physical presence. Ken Livingstone's seat of power, you could say, is British municipal politics given the baseball treatment. No more English cricket whites. Instead, the old game is played out under floodlights and putting the players in lime green pyjamas. Or in the case of City Hall, local democracy has a background of a purple carpet and yellow walls that look good on television, and one of the most conspicuous new buildings in London. Next slide, please. Fundamentally, City Hall looks the way it does because it's trying to tell us something about itself. It's meant to look special, and it co-opts an even more famous landmark, Tower Bridge, to tell us that it's rooted in an idea of the old London and its identity. There are other signs of London's transformation that equally are both symbolic and practical. The Millennium Bridge here, for example, shows how the core of the city, St. Paul's Cathedral, is linked with what was one of its most rundown neighborhoods. It's highly visible, but it also does a lot to the way that people can really move in and around the city. Next slide, please. And as the city has changed, a whole new building type has come into being. The river, the Thames, its greatest landmark, has been rebuilt on both sides with an avalanche of new apartment buildings. Next slide, please. Of variable quality. Next slide, please. Some of which, of course, have the effect of destroying the very thing that they love, the river view, which now seems to be, next slide, please, being turned into a continuous culvert of construction, a wall of windows on both sides of the Thames, looking at one another. Next slide, please. Next slide. London, I think, has gone through this remarkable period of transformation. A succession of rundown inner-city slums from Clerkenwell to Hoxton have seen the transformation into a series of desirable new urban neighborhoods. Business parks have sprouted at Heathrow Airport. Next slide, please. A new subway opened. Next slide, please. Trams have returned to southern suburbs. Sites left empty for decades have filled up. The derelict docks and railway marshalling yards, made redundant by technological and economic change, have been taken in hand. The problem sites that seemed intractable and unfundable have been funded and built. The meanest buildings of the 1960s have been demolished and replaced on a scale that has seen the streets of the square mile of the financial centre running with mud, churned up by construction, bubbling up over the pavements from Paternoster Square to London Wall. London has turned itself inside out. New slide, please. There are new towers planned everywhere. But underneath the changes, there is also a London that is now 2,000 years old, whose memories and structures still shape what happens today. This building is in Wood Street, next to London Wall, where Richard Rogers and Norman Foster have both built the latest incarnation of the office buildings for the Japanese financial institutions that need to operate here. This street itself was first laid out 2,000 years ago. It was used to connect the Roman army's parade ground just outside the city wall with a Roman fortress protecting the city. This is the street in which the Saxon kings built a royal palace and where the chapel of that palace later became a church built by Sir Christopher Wren. These are invisible reminders under the surface of the continuity and the structure that shapes city identity for generation after generation. Next slide, please. 2 minutes. Perhaps I'll forget about all these slides and move on to my final point. Which is really to talk about the things that can actually be used to create a sense of identity in the city as we know it. London is being reshaped on a scale never been seen before. It's been reshaped by the way it's building a new airport, Terminal 5. It's reconstructing its links with mainland Europe through the new Eurostar stations. But it's hard. It's also trying to address those traditional public spaces. Trafalgar Square, for example, which is both a symbolic sign of London's identity and an authentic piece of the substance of London. In that sense, perhaps Cedric Price's point about buildings that become redundant before they're finished might yet be dealt with. If we're going to address a city in the optimistic sense about what it is going to be, it's those marks of identity, which are both symbolic and